This is not your average podcast. This is Writing Techniques with Ken Carroll. Hi, I'm Ken Carroll, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on around here. Let me just make a quick call to find out. Hello?
Hi.
Yeah. Do you know what's going on with this show? Do you know what we're supposed to be doing on this show?
Yeah. I know. I've got it covered. I'm kind of responsible for it.
Okay, well then, maybe you could share with us, what is this whole thing about?
Yeah, well, the title of the show is called Writing Techniques. And the idea is that it's a way to learn writing. Now, a lot of people traditionally, in order to learn writing, they'll use grammar books. And I find that that isn't a very effective way to learn writing.
Okay, well then tell us about a more effective way, will you?
Okay, well, so what I suggest is that we learn through techniques. In other words, we find the very, very best techniques from the very best writers that we can find. From writers from the past or from the present, wherever, it doesn't really matter. As long as we find really tremendous, excellent examples of great writing, so we fish them out and we say, look, what is the technique behind this? How does this writer do this? How did the writer achieve this effect? What makes it good? What makes it strong? And then we try to isolate it and say, you know, this is what it is. This is how it works, so that the listener can then understand the technique and then import that technique into his or her own sort of repertoire of doing things.
Okay, that sounds like an interesting approach, as long as you know what you're doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been teaching languages for 25 years, mostly English, but other languages too. I've taught writing and I've taught all sorts of other things, all related to language learning and language teaching and so on. So yeah, this is something that has evolved for me over many years. So yeah, I guess you could say I have quite a bit of experience in this field.
Okay, so that means that pretty much every day here we'll have techniques. Is that what you're saying? We'll have different techniques from different writers and you'll isolate them and help us to get the idea.
Yeah, that's basically what we'll do. And in just a moment, we'll look at one I think is a really, really useful, really powerful one. And it's about how to engage your readers, how to connect with them, how to pull them into your writing and how to keep them reading and so on. So yeah, very powerful little technique. And we're going to see that in a moment.
That's great. I think you have more stuff lined up. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm also going to, in this show, I'm going to talk about why I think that now is the time to learn writing. Never before in our history has the ability to write, the ability to communicate more generally, but a core part of it is the ability to write. Never before have we ever had the opportunities that we now have if you know how to write. So, you know, good writing can help you to build a personal brand, to stand out, to connect, to build an audience, to sell stuff online. I mean, there's just endless possibilities for writing now. And I'm going to explain my take on why I think now is the time to get better at writing.
Okay, all sounds good. Anything else in this show?
Yeah, there's lots more, actually. I'm also going to talk about how to be an extremist. Not a political extremist, but a writing extremist. And this is something I learned from Seth Godin, who talks about extremism in his book, Free Prize Inside. So Seth talks about the idea that, you know, you shouldn't be bland, you shouldn't be boring, you have to be outstanding in some way, you have to do something different. You have to be something, in this case, something of a writing extremist. So I'm going to talk about how to do that. And I'm going to take a few ideas from my upcoming course. I have a course on Seth Godin's writing coming out soon, which will be available on kencarroll.com.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's an awful lot to cover in one show. Why don't you come over here now and we can just get started with it. So, how do you get people to read your stuff? How do you pull people in and get them to read through your articles or your posts or your PDFs and so on? Well, one way to do it is to create a sense of anticipation. And anticipation means giving your readers a reason to keep on reading. It means giving them the sense that you're taking them somewhere interesting. And there's a very simple technique for presenting information and for creating that type of anticipation. So here it is. You ask questions, but you delay the answers. You ask questions, but you delay the answers. This is the secret to creating anticipation. It's as simple as that. Posing the right questions in the right way will draw people in and it will keep them on the edge of their seats. It's all about the questions. Human curiosity is an incredibly powerful thing. Look at how people can be led around by their noses on the web. It's curiosity, right? The writer uses their curiosity to engage them. So think about how people can sit there for hours, almost helplessly following links that look interesting, even though those links may have no value whatsoever to them. And so in a sense, you can use this same capacity for curiosity in your own writing. You can use questions to mobilize the reader. Now, whether you pose those questions directly, as in nonfiction, or indirectly, as in stories and novels and so on, human curiosity is always at the center of it. Human curiosity may be the single most powerful thing that you can use. Okay, so questions. But what types of questions? Which ones are the most effective? Well, although we're mostly about nonfiction here, I want to look at two questions from the world of fiction. These two questions can create a very strong kind of anticipation that we call suspense. So we're going to look at this question of suspense. Now, suspense is a fascinating thing in and of itself. And I think that the technique of suspense is something that every informed reader should be able to recognize. But there's more to it than that, because the technique can be used in almost any form of writing. You can learn to use it in yours. So here's what you need to know. There are two types of questions that create suspense, and we're going to look at them one by one. Okay, so the first of these questions is the question, what will happen next? And to see it in action, we've come to a place called Cornwall in England, because this is where we find the single greatest example of it that I can think of. So it comes from an old novel called A Pair of Blue Eyes, and it's written by a guy called Thomas Hardy. And in this novel, Hardy takes the question of what will happen next to a whole new level. Actually, he took it to a level about 200 feet above us. Because up there, dangling from the side of the cliff, is the protagonist of the novel. The poor sap's name is Henry Knight, and he's hanging on to the edge for dear life. So here's how it happened. Knight slipped over the edge about an hour ago, and he's hanging on desperately in the hope that someone will come back and help him. That help is supposed to come in the form of a young woman, the woman who accompanied him to the top of the cliff. She just rushed to the nearest village to raise the alarm. But will the help come in time? That's the question that Hardy poses. And no surprises here, of course, he lets us wait for the answer. With this dangling man scene, Hardy gave us a classic case of suspense. By leaving Henry Knight suspended, Hardy leaves the readers suspended. In fact, Hardy literally created what has become known as the cliffhanger with this scene. It's where the term cliffhanger comes from. And I think he gave us the single most memorable example in all of literature of what suspense actually is. As Henry Knight is suspended, so are we suspended. Hardy poses a question, but he makes us wait for the answer. Now, of course, as Henry Knight hangs there, his love interest is out of the scene. Of course, that's important. She's gone to get help. That's important because it gives Hardy lots of space to do some really interesting things with Henry Knight's mind, his thoughts, and so on, as he stares death in the face. Now, it's a very clever thing to do, and Hardy takes the time to play it for all it's worth, which means he's also playing on our need to know what will happen. Will the young woman be able to help him? We have to read on to find out. Now, I guess in the movie version, of course, you'd probably get lots of cross cuts. On one hand, you'd probably have the young woman in the village frantically trying to raise the alarm. On the other hand, you'd probably have scenes of the drop below Henry Knight, 200 feet below him and all that. That would literally heighten the suspense in a visual sense. And so I hope this scene gives us an example of just how what will happen next can be used. It is very often the key to suspense in the action novel. Because as we read these novels, the writer forces us to ask ourselves the question over and over. He doesn't just ask it once, he reformulates it over and over. The situation changes. What will happen next? A new threat emerges. What will happen next? So these types of novelists will happily put their heroes into one abominable danger, one horrendous crisis after another, in order to visit and revisit this question of what will happen next. The author wants to keep this question in our minds, of course. He wants to keep the suspense alive. But there's a second question, and this question can also create tremendous levels of anticipation and suspense. This one is used almost without fail by crime writers. And so, to see this one at work, we've come to the scene of a horrific crime. The second question is not what will happen next, but who did it? Now, pretty much every crime story and every detective novel ever written, as well as most of the TV police dramas ever made, well, most of these are built around this question of who did it. The TV show Who Did It is pretty much the same thing as the whodunit in the old detective novels. They're just variations on a theme, variations on a single question, in fact. And once again, the writer finds ways to keep us asking ourselves this question through the twists and turns of the plot. We have to keep asking ourselves, so who did it? Who did it? Who did it? Now, in this format, whether it's the TV show or the novel or whatever it is, the crime has already been committed, and we just need to know the culprit. I mean, think of all those Agatha Christie stories where we read in order to unmask the killer. And of course, Agatha Christie, just as Thomas Hardy did, she lets us wait. We have to read until the end to find out the answer. Now, in the TV dramas, of course, something very similar always happens. It's not the crime itself, usually, that matters so much as how the culprit will be caught. I mean, think of it. How many police shows begin with a dead body on the ground and the cops arriving on the scene and the hero cop is there to try to figure out who did it? We've seen it a million times. And it's all based on one question. Now, the who did it question is based on causality. So clearly, the causality question can create a tremendous sense of anticipation and suspense, particularly if it's stroked and manipulated by a skillful writer. So here's a suggestion. One way to learn about this skill is to pick up a collection of classic crime stories. Now, I know some people say, well, crime stories are not my thing, but one thing I can guarantee you, once you've read through a series of those stories, you'll know a great deal about anticipation and suspense.
Well, I must say, I think this show seems to be coming together quite nicely now, in fact. Let me just ask this gentleman over here. You, sir, what say you? What do you think of the podcast so far? It's rather good, isn't it?
I've had worse insults than that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you've had some really, really bad ones.
What do you mean by that?
No, I'm just saying.
Okay, so how do we put these techniques to use in non-fiction terms? Well, actually, these are ideas that we explore in some more details on the courses. But I can make a few general points here. So first of all, notice that Hardy's fictional examples, just like the crime detective examples, create questions in our minds by manipulating the situation. Hardy doesn't come out and sort of ask the reader openly, you know, will Henry Knight survive? That's not the way you do it. You don't do that in fiction because asking the reader directly obviously would insert the writer into the story and make it look artificial and so on. And the whole point about novels is, you know, they're supposed to create this illusion that you're actually experiencing reality and so on.
So instead, Hardy embeds the question into the scene. You know, you're forced to ask yourself, will Henry Knight survive or won't he? So that's just one difference to be clear there, because in nonfiction, you can ask the questions explicitly. So this is, you know, this is helpful. Let's say you're writing, I don't know, let's say you were writing a PDF on social media usage or something. And let's say you've got some, you know, you've got lots of insights and information to share, but you obviously want to make the report or the PDF, whatever it is, you want to make it more engaging, more interesting. You want to create an element of anticipation for the reader. So one way to do it is to promise the big answers to the questions at the beginning. Just to pose the big questions at, say, at the beginning, and then tell the reader that you will answer them, you know, as you proceed. You tell them up front that you've got big insights, but you just delay it. You give them to them step by step. And rather than listing them one by one, you could offer them in reverse order of importance. And so you got some buildup and so on. So you come to the most significant point at the end. And you can give the readers hints along the way as to, you know, what's coming and so on. So there are many, many simple ways to use anticipation, but they do form around the simple idea of using questions. You've got your key information, you sit back and you ask yourself, well, in this report, what is the single most compelling question I can answer? And then you pose it up front. So that's it. I think one other interesting thing is that once you start to use this technique of anticipation, you start to get a feel for it. And it has many, I've really oversimplified it here because, you know, we've reduced it to two simple questions. But believe me, when you work with the technique, you can put it to some really sophisticated use, even if it is reduced to this sort of simple idea of two types of questions. I think another thing that will happen is you'll start to see the technique all over the place. You know, a good podcast should create an anticipation, as a good radio show, a good TV show, a good book, a good anything. So the idea is that you can apply sort of variations on these techniques of anticipation and suspense to pretty much any situation in which you want to hold the interest of your audience. You could use it in reports to live it up. You could use it in your blog posts, headlines, to get people to read them and so on. You could embed it into your book or even into your emails. You know, radio hosts and podcasters, as we said, they use it all the time. So I think what will happen is you'll see the technique in different guises, but just you can be now aware that at the heart of the most forms of anticipation and suspense, that they're variations on two kinds of questions. One is, who did it? And the other is, what will happen next?
So where did he get himself to? It seems he's, I'm going to find him. It seems he's speaking to a group of people about these amazing new opportunities that exist. Never before in history, as he says, have these opportunities existed. I think I'm at the right place. I think this is it. This looks like it. Let me just go inside. Yeah, this is it. I think he's going to start at any moment. Excuse me, can I just get past you there? This is my seat. Yeah, okay. All right, good. Yeah, I think he's just about to speak. This evening, I have a message that I want to share with you. And I want this message to sink in slowly so that you can meditate on it. This message is for anyone who wants to lead a more self-determined life. Anyone who wants to build a personal brand, anyone who wants to seek new opportunities in a new environment of a connected economy, a creative economy, or however you want to term it. Now, I'm not addressing people who necessarily see themselves as writers in any form. I'm addressing people who think more in terms of taking action. People who want to make an impression on the world. People who are maybe open to the idea now that writing can transform who they are and can transform the possibilities that exist for them in the world. Because here, in very broad terms, is the point I want to make, and it's this one. The context for writing
has shifted radically. Let me repeat it. The context for writing has shifted radically. And the implications for all of us in this are huge. Now, 25 years ago, when I began teaching, writing in the professional sense used to mean writing business letters or memos or reports and so on. Now, it's very sad to say, but that's what was regarded as writing in the professional world. And it bores me to tears just to think about it. Writing memos? That's what writing was about? Unfortunately, yes, that's what was writing in a professional context was about. Now, talk about a lack of imagination. It was truly sad. But what's even more astonishing is that this is how many people still think about writing in the professional context. And it's writing in the most limiting, stifling, nauseating, horrendous way. A way that in which we never uncover the potential that writing has to offer us. No wonder that we never learn to write well. But now the context has shifted radically. Now we write in ways and write for purposes that didn't even exist 5 years ago. Now I know it's a cliche, but it's true. We live in a new world. We live in a new professional or business world, however you want to term it. It has already been transformed, but we've yet to come to terms with all of this transformation means. But of all the characteristics of this new world of ours, the one that concerns us here today is this elevated role that writing now plays in what we all do every day. Now, people will tell you we live in the post-literary society. That is not true. Never in the past have we been so dependent on writing. Raise your hand, someone in this room, in a professional context, who doesn't write every single day. And writing in this new context isn't about how to format a memo or the etiquette of a business letter. Please do me a favor. The new writing is far, far bigger than that. And the new writing offers us far greater possibilities than that. The new writing is liberating. It's artistic. It's creative. But most of all, it can transform your life. It's a path, I believe, to self-determination. Because something has changed. Something big, something very big has changed. And if we fail to see what's happening, then we'll fail to take the opportunities that change can yield for us. So what is the big shift? What is it that has changed? What is so dramatically different now? What happened? Well, what happened is the platform. The platform is what happened. The platform. The emergence of the personal platform, essentially the blog or the personal website. This now means that we're in a new reality with a new context, with new purposes and new possibilities for writing. This is big. The great shift that this has brought about is a shift into the era of an empowered individual. She is now empowered in ways we could only dream of a few years ago. She can now do things that only large organizations could do in the past. She can market herself and market her ideas. She can create a personal brand, a brand me, and potentially reach millions of others with it. She can write and talk and do video and create things that enable her to reach like-minded people anywhere in the world. She can be aggressive and creative and magnanimous and whatever else the platform allows, which is a great deal. She can do what she damn well pleases relative to just a few years ago. This is why it's all about the platform. The platform is your personal brand. It's about you announcing to the world what you believe in and announcing how you intend to make it a better place. It's about your contribution, your talents, and your abilities. It's about you saying who you are, what you stand for, and why anyone should care. The new context for writing means it's now your turn to take the metaphorical microphone. Or in this case, to literally take the microphone if you do these talks. But what happens after you market yourself and your ideas? Well, that's when it gets real. I can't even count the ways that you could use a personal platform to solve life's problems. But let me just throw out a few. The big choice, I guess, is whether to stay on in your present course or to change it. Unlike ever before, there are now options. You may choose to go solo or you may choose to stay in your present job. In either event, the platform is relevant, deeply relevant.
In fact, it's going to be essential to either course, whichever one you choose. Because people can now use the personal platform to create and sell digital products, PDFs, ebooks, reports, video, audio products, and so on. And they do so without the need for an organization in the mix. They can, in other words, go it alone. The age of the small business and the solopreneur is here. Going solo is an option like never before. Now, it's hard to overstate what this means to the free spirit, to the individual who wants a life of self-determination and freedom. You always wanted to carve out your own future, right? Well, good, now it's possible. Actually, now the reasons why you should carve out your own future are truly compelling. The question now is, why wouldn't you take your destiny into your own hands? It's all possible. You can sell yourself and sell your ideas, sell your talents. And I don't just mean sell in the sense of a cash transaction. I mean selling your beliefs, your influence, your contribution, whatever it is you want to achieve. The platform is as real for the artist or the social activist as it is for the entrepreneur. So some people are using their platforms to demonstrate expertise or position themselves as authorities on subjects from sculpting to raising chickens. And some are selling goods and services to their audiences that they build around their platforms, from speaking and consulting services to online courses, whatever it may be. The possibilities are endless. Now, others, of course, don't want to leave the confines of their organizations, and that's fine, that's great. They use the platform to establish a reputation within an organization or to pursue a new direction within it. And again, they do this by demonstrating who they are, what they do, and why anyone should trust them to solve problems. It's still about the platform. Then there's the question of leadership. Don't get me started on this. The potential for building what Seth Godin calls tribes is endless too, as is the potential to lead those tribes and to solve the world's problems and make a living while you're doing it. I know I'm making it sound easy here, but it's all possible and it is all doable. We know this because we've seen people do it. In fact, I guess I myself am part of this wave of people who have decided to plunge in myself. Ask me in a year how it all worked out for me. But in the meantime, you can see how lots of others are doing it and doing it successfully. But the single most important point I want to make to you this evening, the key to all of what I've said here, is this. For the great majority of us, the success of our platforms will be a function of how well we learn to communicate. And by communicate, I mean by writing. The ability to write is essential to the platform. Writing is at the center of the new marketing, the new branding, and the new entrepreneurship. Writing is where it's at. And it's my job to try to pull out some of the very best writing techniques.
Okay, so it seems like it's time to get out of this place. That was a pretty good speech. I think I see how it's all coming together now. So in the first part of the show, he told us about the techniques, and that's what the focus of this show is going to be each week. Techniques that we can take from excellent writers and adopt them to our own purposes. And now with this speech, he's telling us that there's a whole new ballgame. There's a whole new world of writing possibilities out there for people who can write, and it comes from the platform. But it's time to get back to the studio now, because we've got to get started on the third part of this show. And in this part, he's going to tell us about Seth Godin. I have a feeling that he's going to use Seth Godin to relate these two ideas, the technique and the platform. I'm almost back home now. Let me just get inside into the studio. Can you believe it? He's here. How did you do that? How did you get here?
I hurried. But listen, we don't have time to go into that right now. I want to get on and do the Seth Godin stuff, as you know, right?
Okay, that sounds good. Let's try and do that. Let's talk about Seth Godin.
I'll be releasing a new writing course in the next couple of weeks. It's based on the work of Seth Godin. Yes, he of the 17 books, the 1 million blog subscribers, the global brand name, that Seth Godin.
Because lots of people have discussed Seth Godin's ideas, but no one, to my knowledge, has ever done an in-depth analysis of his writing, certainly not at the level of his techniques. Even Godin himself blogs only rarely about the art of writing. And yet writing is at the center of almost everything he's achieved. He couldn't achieve what he has achieved without the skill of writing. So over a period of 6 months, I studied Seth's writing in depth, and now I have a course that I've built around it. In the course, I'm going to give my take on how he does it, the secrets and the techniques behind his writing success. Now, Godin writes simply and in a straightforward manner. He isn't difficult or literary in any sense, and you won't need to suffer through any grammatical expositions or deadening rules or abstractions to get him. What you will see, and in non-technical language, is what he does write and how that contributes to his success. You'll get to see his writing techniques laid bare. Now, this is a writing course that touches on the marketing, not the other way around. Everything in the course is designed to stimulate your own writing. But what I hope is doubly stimulating is when you see how Seth uses his platform to build his brand and position himself as a thought leader with global influence. Seth is perhaps the world's greatest exponent of personal branding on the platform. Now, I've learned so much about Seth, I feel I could probably do more and more lessons on him, but let me throw out a few ideas here. These will give you something of a taste of the kind of thing I want to cover on the course. Ask people about their impression of Seth Godin, and they tell you that he's a think-outside-the-box kind of guy, a maverick, maybe even a kind of corporate malcontent. And to an extent, he is all of those things. But what I want you to understand is this. He's way more radical than that. He is an extremist. Now, in his book, Free Prize Inside, Godin explains the idea of edgecraft. Edgecraft is a way for marketers to get radical. Edgecraft is about finding and developing extreme qualities in your products and highlighting them over the bland. Because products that are just a little bit different and a little bit better than what already exists are bland. And bland is never going to cut through the advertising clutter that surrounds us. Bland is not on the edge. But edgecraft, according to Seth Godin, goes beyond mere differentiation. It means going beyond the obvious to find what he calls the free prize inside the product. It's an attempt to uncover its purple cow quality. Here's what he has to say, and this comes from the book Free Prize Inside, and I quote, "To be purple, you have to be more than different. You have to be extreme. You have to live on the edge. If people aren't blown away, they won't talk about it. If they don't talk about it, it doesn't spread fast enough and you don't grow." Now, his reference here is to the marketing of products, of course, but it applies equally well to spreading ideas, to building personal brands, to selling books, and to writing in general. Your themes, the things you choose to write about, though probably not your writing style, have to be radical, on the edge, a little bit extreme. Which means you can't just do the safe thing. You can't just regurgitate other people's ideas or state the things that people already know. The platform isn't supposed to be a safety zone. There's no way to establish a brand around blandness or platitudes or nonchalant ideas. The platform has to be about committing to new and unexpected things. It has to be a purple cow. Now, this means, of course, that you have to think about the themes and the topics that you write about. Are your goals for your writing and for your platform too safe? Are they obvious? Do they lack an extreme edge? You have to think about these things. And it suggests the need for originality also, maybe even a radical originality, which could be a problem. Because not everyone can have constant radical insights on a daily basis. Not everyone can churn it out like Seth. Or can they? The good news is that that level of originality isn't entirely necessary, because there are ways of being original and being creative and prolific that don't come out of pure inspiration alone. They come out of focused work and good techniques, writing techniques, creative techniques, things that can be learned. And those are the techniques that I explore in the course. So in the meantime, the moral of the story is this: get radical with your platform. Don't pussy around with the superficial, the surface level. There are millions of people out there writing, and there will be ever more of them. So you have to be able to say something radical about your subject, even if the subject is only knitting. You have to be able to say something that surprises or changes people's attitudes. You have to shake it up. So learn from the master. Safe is no longer safe. And I think there's great irony in the fact that Seth Godin's extremism, rather than his need for safety, explains his success.
Okay, that's almost it for today. Let me just tell you what's coming up in the next episodes. A lot, actually. From popular culture to high culture, from Leo Tolstoy to John Grisham, I don't care where the techniques come from, as long as they're good writing techniques. So I'll continue to uncover the techniques behind the writing, from the ebooks to screenwriting, from marketing and personal branding, from web copy to sales copy. Wherever there's good stuff, I'll pull out the best techniques and I'll show you how to use them. And I'll be showing you how all of this applies on the platform. This is the time to master the art of writing. So imagine you learn to tell the good from the bad. Imagine you really learn to develop the skill of identifying great writing. And imagine then that you begin to produce it. That's what we're here for. And so in each of the upcoming podcasts, you can expect to hear a lot about techniques, 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 and particularly how techniques work well on the platform. Now, that means whether you're writing a blog or ebooks or PDFs or writing a fully fledged book or whatever it is, as long as the techniques are good and useful, we'll pull them out and we'll show you how to use them. Now, so just some of the topics I want to cover. I'll be looking at the fundamentals of good writing. I'll offer a short course of the basic stuff that you have to know about writing, a logical starting point for someone who has never really looked at their writing in any detail and would like to then just make progress with it. So that'll come out pretty soon. As I said, I'll also produce a short course on writing appreciation so that you can learn to tell the good stuff from the bad stuff, because the good stuff comes before the production. Before you can really write well, you have to be able to say what is good writing. You have to be able to identify it. And there's more. We'll be looking at the super writers. Who do we have in the pipeline? Yes, Gladwell. We'll be looking at Malcolm Gladwell. We'll even be taking a look at people like Anton Chekhov, the Russian writer. There's so much to learn from these people. We'll be looking too at super articles or super books, pulling out the best technique from them. I'll have a series on the greatest book titles ever. So yes, we'll have courses. We'll have tutorials. Some will be free. Some will be paid. We'll see that as we go along. So I'm here to help you to get better at writing. I'm here to work with you over time. I'll use non-technical language. I'll use methods that anyone can understand to uncover these techniques and help you to work them. So what are you struggling with? Let me know and I'll see what I can do. Oh, and in the meantime, one other suggestion for you. You can go to kencarroll.com right now and you can pick up a free ebook. This is the result of 3 years of very intensive study for me when I worked very intensively on the techniques, finding the greatest techniques for writing. And these are the 10 techniques that personally helped me more than any other. It's about 30, 35 pages with these 10 techniques outlined with examples, how you use them and how you apply them. That's on kencarroll.com. It's free. You just go ahead and help yourself. So please let me know if you've got any questions, if you've got any struggles, you've got any other points you'd like me to talk about, feel free to drop me a line, let me know one way or the other. I'll be happy to see what I can do to help. I leave you with some music. This is my own music. The music you hear in the podcast is me. I produce it, I write it, and so on. This is my ode to the Smiths.